Welcome to SLU Law Summations, presenting brief looks at legal matters that matter to you by St. Louis University School of Law, located in the heart of downtown St. Louis.
With an election case involving who is on the ballot headed to the United States Supreme Court and various others bubbling to the surface, this election season promises to be filled with excitement. Between voter access, gerrymandering cases, elected officials pushed out of their district, these are certainly unprecedented times. In this episode, we are joined by election law expert Josh Douglas. Professor Douglas spent this past fall semester as a visiting professor here at SLU Law. He is currently back at his home institution of Rosenberg College of Law at the University of Kentucky. Professor Douglas is also the host of the new podcast, Democracy Optimist. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Well, let's get started. So first, what is bound to be a pretty consequential decision by a state Supreme Court, at least. Late last year, the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that that former President Trump could not be on the ballot because of his violation of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which is something that I feel like it's become a buzzword that we probably never thought that we would be using at this point. Can you bring us up to date on that? And what is next, and what does this mean, like, for our election, particularly the primaries?
Sure. So, yeah, this has been a question that's been bubbling around courts and election officials, for the past several months. And then you see that both the Colorado Supreme Court and the Maine Secretary of State ruled that Donald Trump is not eligible to be president because of his activities surrounding the 2020 election. And that clause you mentioned, the 14th Amendment, Section 3, basically says that anyone who took an oath to defend the U.S. Constitution and thereby or thereafter engages in or supports an insurrection should not be eligible for future office. So a handful of courts around the country have considered challenges to its eligibility. Most have ruled that either he is eligible or that there's some procedural reason for not deciding the case. But as you noted, the Colorado Supreme Court on a 4-3 decision ruled that he is ineligible under this insurrection clause. And then the Maine Secretary of State did so as well. The U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear an appeal from the Colorado Supreme Court's decision. The oral argument is set for February 8th. I suspect the court will try to rule somewhat quickly after that, because the machines of the Colorado elections and elections everywhere else will kick into play. We need to print ballots. So the timing is pretty tight, but the court will issue an order at some point. And I think an open question is whether the court issues a ruling on the merits, actually providing scope to this 14th Amendment question, or if the court punts and for procedural or other reasons decides not to hear the case.
And there is a stay, right? So if they had to print the ballots tomorrow, he would be on there, correct?
Yeah, the Colorado Supreme Court itself basically stayed its decision and said that, he is eligible or he should be on the ballot until the U.S. Supreme Court makes a decision. But of course, if it turns out he's not eligible, you don't really want ballots going out that has his name on it. So it's unprecedented. Everyone wants to know, how's the court going to rule? I think it's a really hard thing to predict because there's really no precedent whatsoever on this.
It feels like we use that word a lot, but it's so true. So in your forthcoming book, you focused on particularly how the United States Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. Aside from this potential case out of Colorado, because obviously taking someone off the ballot could be argued that way, how else have you seen this happen?
So the book, and it's called The Court Versus the Voters, The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights, comes out in May. And what it does is it makes an argument that, and it's written for the general public, right? So it's written in a very accessible way. And the basic premise is that although many people have heard of cases like Citizens United about campaign finance, or Shelby County about the Voting Rights Act, or Bush v. Gore, which resolved the 2000 presidential election, There's actually case law going back 50 years that laid the foundation for the court underprotecting the constitutional right to vote. So I started the book with a case from 1983 involving the 1980 presidential election and the run by independent candidate John Anderson. And, you know, my students who were in election law with me in the fall know the case very well, Anderson versus Celebrezze. I tell the behind-the-scenes story of that case, talk about the actual people involved. I interviewed the lawyers involved, and tell a narrative about how that case laid the foundation for underprotection of voting rights. Chapter two is about a case called Burdick versus Takushi, which involved Hawaii's ban on write-in voting. And this kind of interesting guy, Alan Burdick, challenged, he wanted to write in a candidate. He didn't like any of the candidates. We actually tracked down Alan Burdick and I interviewed him for the book, which is really interesting. And again, I tell the story of that case. And in doing so, explain how the court has lowered the protection for voting rights and given states kind of wide authority to enact whatever election rules that they want. Now, the second half of the book talks about cases from the past 5 to 10 years, you know, including things like the Shelby County case about the Voting Rights Act and Citizens United. So I dive in deeply and tell the real story of those cases as well. But the basic premise is that the court really has been anti-democracy or anti-voter, at least, and has been so for about 50 years.
And I imagine a lot of the kind of like that Hawaii case is kind of involved with or has to do a lot with like how we're hearing the states are different from the write-in voting, and that, you know, that makes a lot of the elections different and not write-in, mail-in, sorry. I imagine that is going to come to a head at some point too.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that people don't fully realize is that we don't really have one election day. We have 50 election days, or 51, including D.C., that all happen at the same time with all different rules. And, you know, that's a feature of the U.S. Constitution, which does delegate authority to the state to run elections. But also when you have some states that make it much harder for people to participate, that is a function of the U.S. Supreme Court's refusal to robustly protect voting rights under the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah. So that's not your only book. So you, in your 2019 book, you, which I believe is titled Vote for Us, or is that U.S.? Is that a play on words?
It's a play on words there.
Okay.
Yeah.
How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. You discuss the positive trajectory of our elections in the United States in regards to voter access. So what does that look like?
Yeah, so when I tell people I wrote a book that tells the good news of voting rights, most people say, well, that can't be a whole book. It was just one page long. There's not a lot of good news out there. You know, it's actually a whole book that tells the stories of individuals on the ground in communities all over the country that are working to make our elections more inclusive, more convenient, and more democratic. So I talk about various voting reforms like ranked choice voting, the expansion of vote by mail, the lowering of the voting age to 16 for local and school board elections in a handful of communities. And in fact, in Newark, New Jersey, just lowered the voting age to 16 for school board elections in Newark. So the book is kind of, you know, the antidote to all the doom and gloom out there, providing some good news stories. Of, I call them democracy champions, these everyday Americans who are working to fix the system through grassroots movements. And in doing so, you know, the evolution of the right to vote has been push and pull, and yet we've marched towards greater inclusion. And the book tells the story of that, makes an argument for why these reforms are good for democracy. So in many ways, you can compare the two books, you know, the first book, Vote for Us, is a much more positive look at elections and election law. And the second book, The Court versus the Voters, is kind of the bad news, and at least the bad news from the perspective of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right. There's always got to be a little bit of both, right?
Yeah. And then, of course, importantly, in the new book, The Court versus the Voters, the last chapter also talks about solutions. So I'm someone who always thinks, you know, even when we're diagnosing the problems, we need to latch on to, okay, what can we do about it? And so the conclusion to the new book talks about various reforms that we might consider to help solve the problem of the underprotection of the constitutional right to vote.
Well, great. And that comes out in May, right?
Yeah, May 14th.
Okay, cool.
And it's right around my birthday. And I hope to make it back toward to St. Louis sometime in 2024 to give a talk about the book.
Great, so yeah. Certainly that'd be awesome.
Let the SLU community know when
Yeah, so, okay. Back to some, I guess, more less positive news. Media reports since the 2020 election paint a picture of dire straits of our election system. Do you think the 2020 election and all the allegations of fraud have changed the way our election system has been viewed and how we can move forward from that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly 2020 was a blight in terms of the spread of disinformation and falsehoods. Unfortunately, we're seeing the reality of the old adage that if you say something enough times, people will start to believe it. And let me be, of course, abundantly clear that there was no widespread fraud in the 2020 election. Joe Biden legitimately won. And, you know, losing an election doesn't mean you lost because of fraud. You know, and the proper response in a democracy is not to challenge the result because of some made-up phantom of election fraud, but to fight to convince voters the next time around.
Right.
So, you know, that's the bad news here. You know, the good news is that there's a lot of people working to explain to the public why those allegations are totally fraudulent. And trying to spread the good information. Now, you know, the thing that probably concerns me the most with respect to the 2020 election is not only people believing the lie, but also state legislatures responding by passing laws that restrict voting access, really for no good reason. And we've seen a lot of that in some key places, you know, Missouri, including Missouri.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a waterfall effect. So we'll see how this year goes. So I mentioned in the intro, I believe, a little bit about gerrymandering. So earlier this year, a North Carolina congressman, Jeff Jackson, was basically written out of office because of the change in the districts. How often does this happen? And then is there any legal recourse for the voters of that district involved? Because, I mean, they obviously voted for him. And then he's not there. So I guess I've never heard of that or not familiar with it happening.
So, so the broader question you have here is about partisan gerrymandering in general, right? The drawing of district lines in such a way to try to dictate an outcome. This happens all the time and both parties do it. There's examples of Republicans gerrymandering in North Carolina, examples of Democrats gerrymandering in places like Illinois and New York. And so, yes, this happens all the time. And there's court challenges, I mean, in virtually every single state after the 2020 redistricting cycle, there has been litigation. And it's really a patchwork. So the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Rucho in 2019, which I also talk about in my new book, basically said federal courts are not going to hear these cases, that the federal courthouse doors are closed to claims of partisan gerrymandering, saying that the U.S. Constitution does not provide sufficient standards. In spite of all the evidence of various different metrics one can use to test whether a map is unfair. Some state courts have been open to challenges to gerrymanders under state constitutions. And so there's been some success in some places. And then we also see a push among the electorate in places where they can push for it to adopt independent redistricting commissions. Now, with respect to your specific example, I'd have to look into it more carefully, but I suspect that, well, one of two things probably happened. I don't know about this example specifically, but either, you know, this individual was simply kind of drawn out of his district and so couldn't run in the next election, but was still able to finish out the term. I have seen a couple examples where a new map is passed and then kind of overnight the numbers change and the lines change and then the individual is no longer representing the same place they had been before the new map. Now, this actually happened in Kentucky after the 2010 redistricting cycle, and the Kentucky Supreme Court struck it down. So, you know, that's a little bit different if you're actually basically changing where your district is overnight based on a new map. I'll tell you, in North Carolina, there's been tons of litigation about the maps that were drawn in both the federal courts and the state courts, including in the state court system, the North Carolina Supreme Court striking down the map under the state constitution. But then after an election, four members of the North Carolina Supreme Court that flipped the seats of two individuals, and North Carolina elects their judges on a partisan basis, so with Democrat and Republican labels. And the court went from essentially a 4-3 Democratic majority to a 5-2 Republican majority. And the Republican majority reversed the decision that had been issued only a month prior by the prior majority. And, you know, there's a lot of concern about that when you see courts changing the rules because of a change in the composition that's explicitly partisan.
Hmm. That's very interesting. And then was it Arkansas or Alabama where they had a gerrymandering case go all the way up to the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah, Alabama, in which the court actually upheld the lower court's decision that the map violated the Voting Rights Act because in Alabama, the map makers drew a 7-district map for their congressional seat, so 7 seats, only one of which had a majority of voters that identified as racial minorities, what we refer to as a majority-minority district. Mm-hmm. And yet the population of Alabama would suggest that there should be 2 majority-minority districts. Right. The lower court found that it was a violation of the Voting Rights Act. The U.S. Supreme Court actually upheld that. And so you think, oh, maybe there's good news there, right? That the Supreme Court kind of upheld the application of the Voting Rights Act, except for that was a 5-4 decision. Uh-huh. And Justice Kavanaugh wrote a concurrence in which he said, basically, yeah, I'm going along right now, but I'm not sure that this provision of the Voting Rights Act should live indefinitely, and I would be open to considering whether it's gone past its time if the right arguments are made. So he sort of signaled that, you know, he was a swing vote with a 5-4 decision. It only takes one to go the other way. Mm-hmm. And he signaled that, you know, yeah, I'm going along with the majority in this instance, or I'm helping to form the majority to strike down this map, but I may not be so open to challenges to or to the use of the Voting Rights Act in this way in a future case.
You know what? You got to read those concurrent opinions, I guess.
So what it tells you is that even opinions that are decisions that the media identifies as positive, maybe underlying this underneath the surface, are not so positive after all.
Right. Yeah. He really slid that one in there. So what do you think? We kind of touched on this a little bit. What do you think is the biggest threat to this upcoming election cycle?
I mean, it's the unknown, first of all, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we couldn't have told you this time in 2020 that a pandemic would break out that would affect the 2020 election as much as it did. So, you know, in some ways, we don't know. You know, 2016, foreign interference in the election was the big storyline. You know, I think threats to election officials are really concerning, and we're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing a lot of people who, you know, worked as county clerks or as poll workers leave. And so there's a massive drain of knowledge about how to run elections. So I'm pretty concerned about that. I'm obviously concerned about a potential presidential candidate who is already refusing to accept the results of a free and fair election before any votes are cast. I mean, Donald Trump did that in 2020, and we saw what happened. And, you know, I think that every conversation regarding the presidential candidates, and particularly Trump, because he's made it an issue himself, should focus on the need to protect democracy, and democracy requires the losers, you know, accepting defeat. So I'm concerned about that. And the disinformation. And then, you know, the other thing is AI. To what extent will artificial intelligence shape the ways in which the campaigns are run, and especially, again, the disinformation? So there's a lot of things that are concerning. But the good news is that there are a lot of really smart people thinking a lot about these issues and trying to figure out, you know, how to make sure the election system will be secure and will have a fair election.
Mm-hmm. So on that note, what positive changes have you seen or hope to see in our system? I mean, given the title of your podcast, Democracy Optimist, I assume this is something that you're going to be covering.
Yeah. And, you know, I chose that name on purpose because mm-hmm. on the one hand, there's so much doom and gloom out there that, you know, one solution, and it feels like what a lot of people will do, is lament the doom and gloom and then throw up their hands in despair and say, well, right. you know, we can't do anything. Mm-hmm. I'm a more positive, optimistic person by nature, but also think that the right solution is to say, okay, here are the challenges. And mm-hmm. here are this, then, okay, let's figure out the solutions. And I'm also someone who thinks that it's very useful to point to solutions that have already been implemented that maybe mm-hmm. can be spread to other places. So Democracy Optimist, my tagline is bringing you the good, the bad, and the ugly in voting rights with mm-hmm. a dose of hope sprinkled in. And that okay. dose of hope, I think, is a useful or an important component of that. So right. so where's the good news? I mean, we can look at places like Michigan that have adopted various new voting laws in the past mm-hmm. couple of years, requiring 9 days of early voting, making it easier to register, making it a crime and increasing the penalties for influence or threatening election workers, right, to make sure that we're mm-hmm. protecting these people who are on the front lines of democracy. And then even just little kind of technical things, which most voters probably don't pay attention to, but can make a big difference. Like Michigan passed a new rule that if you have a mail-in ballot, you sent your ballot by the mail, and there's some technical error on it, like, you know, you didn't put the zip code on the correct yeah. spot on the envelope. Now mm-hmm. the election officials are supposed to contact the voter and say, hey, there's a mistake, and let you fix those clerical errors. Wow. Like, that's going to lead to fewer votes being thrown out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are examples like that really all over the country in terms of proposed ways to make the election system more open to people. Also, mm-hmm. civics education. There's a lot being done with respect to civics education to try to make sure that we have an educated electorate. So I'm not naive about the challenges facing our elections and the 2024 election in particular, but mm-hmm. I think the better frame, and a frame that is perhaps not as shared, you know, sort of contrary, is to be a democracy optimist. So that way we can strive toward what, you know, the solutions to help fix our system.
Right. Like, be the change you want to see in the world kind of scenario, that kind of.
Yeah. Right. right. And you know, democracy, what's the old saying? Democracy is not a spectator sport. Mm-hmm. And so it does require all of us, and you know, yeah. it requires voters. I am fortunate to have conversations with election officials, with secretaries of state, with voters. And I hear lots of guarded optimism, right? Guarded mm-hmm. because there's very significant threats and we shouldn't ignore those. You know, I'm not an optimist in that everything is rosy and so we don't have to do anything.
Right.
I am a guarded, I mean, democracy guarded optimist doesn't sound mm-hmm. doesn't have as nice of a catch to it.
Yeah.
but my optimism is guarded given that the recognition of the threats to mm-hmm. democracy. But again, the better approach in my view is to be a democracy optimist in that we focus on what's working, what are the good news in voting rights, and let's expand upon those while also fighting back against efforts to undermine democracy.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate that we're ending on a positive note, which I wouldn't have suspected coming into this. So I appreciate that. Yeah.
And again, what's you know, the alternative is to wallow in our despair.
Yeah.
And I think that's not as productive.
No, definitely not. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to having you back sometime this year.
Thanks so much. I had a great time at SLU, and it's great to be able to chat.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for SLU Law Summations, produced by St. Louis University School of Law.